Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, ho, ho. And welcome to the Starting Line podcast with me, Rich Lee, for this very, very special Christmas special? Christmas bonus episode? One of those two things, right? It's been a little bit of time since you've heard from me, so this will hopefully be a nice surprise as it drops into your podcast in tray. And I hope you are having a lovely, lovely December and excited about whatever festivities might lie ahead. Some of you will have hopefully seen my social media posts about our upcoming filmed video interview with the actor Brian Cox. It was incredible. The man has, I mean, he's been across 176 different projects we worked out, and we speak in depth about a ton of different things. That's going to be the first episode of Series 2 that will come out in the earlier months of 2024. It is yet to be sorted as to when that actually will go. I'm recording others in the new year, so stand by for those. So, today's episode. If you are offended by swear words and generally depraved themes being used in a comedic way by a musical comedian, a comedic musician, not quite sure which one of the two we do land on with him, but either way, as an entertainer, this week's guest has been incredibly successful, so qualifies as a Starting Line guest up top for that reason. He has had 4 top 20 hits and got to number 5 in the Christmas charts with one of his songs a couple of short years ago. He is back on the campaign trail this year, but not for himself, for a band called The Crackpots, and he is hoping to help Proper Christmas get to the Christmas number 1. I have a feeling that given we recorded this on the sad day when Shane McGowan died, there's probably going to be another number 1 this year, but you know, let's try and get it up the charts nonetheless. So this is a fascinating conversation, wide-ranging conversation with somebody that I've long admired and has got an incredibly different, quirky sense of humour. So if that is not for you, again, look in the description. I'll write a little bit more there. I just wanted to give you, in the intro up top, the chance to not listen if you don't want to. That's okay. This episode doesn't have to be for you. But for those that do stick with it, honestly, it's the most I've laughed doing one of these. He is an incredibly, incredibly funny man, and it's just a pleasure to spend the time that we did together. So if you're still listening to this point, if you haven't turned it off by now, all that's left to say is, without further ado, I bring to you my conversation with Cunt, with a K, which makes it okay, all right? It's not the actual word, is it? Enjoy. Mate, thank you very much for coming. We are in Stu Whiffin, a mutual friend's studio, and it's pretty fucking cool.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Posh.
It's funny because outside it looks like a shithole.
Yeah.
you come
yeah, it looks like the kind of place you'd go to be chained up tortured and murdered.
I asked him what was in all the units, and he's like, yeah, just bodies yeah. Left and right.
It's very Reservoir Dogs from the outside, isn't it? You can imagine coming in and finding someone strapped to a chair with their ear missing.
There is a Christmas song coming out. Stu mentioned that you have something of a hand in helping to promote it. What is it? Who is it? When is it coming out?
Well, in previous years, obviously, like, we've done our own Christmas chart campaign. And,
yeah, you've done some really nice songs. What kind of songs have you done?
Well, we had one called, it all started off in 2020 with Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt.
How'd you come up with that?
Well, I thought it was fairly obvious, but lots of people hadn't realised it at that time. And that got to number 5 in the Christmas chart, sort of completely unexpected.
What was around it? What other songs were? Are we talking about Mariah Carey?
Yeah. Mariah Carey's Christmas song, Wham's Christmas song. I think Justin Bieber had one out that year. We beat Justin Bieber, Ed Sheeran, Liam Gallagher's new song. We done better than all those. But I think, yeah, you're always up against it, you know, yeah. Because they've all got big record labels and, you know, PR budgets and what have you. And we do sort of, you know, an online campaign through Facebook and all that.
Radio 1 wouldn't even say the name of the song. They wouldn't name you, would they?
No, they didn't name the band. They didn't name the song.
They just said, in at number 5, a naughty song.
Yeah, they wouldn't even say who the song was about.
Yeah.
And that's kind of carried on through subsequent years. The following year, we had one called Boris Johnson is still a fucking cunt.
Again, genius. Well, where did this moment of inspiration?
Well, funnily,
he still was.
Funny enough, he still was, and he still is. I mean, you could just do that every year.
Yeah.
Still a fucking cunt again. Yeah, so that was 2021. In 2022, we did Fuck the Tories, and that got a number 7. And then here we are in 2023. And the trouble is, the last few years have got quite a negative message because, you know, things are largely fucked. And so this year we were going to do something a bit more positive. And then I came across this song by a band called The Crackpots with a K.
Definitely nothing to do with you, though.
No, it's nothing
to do with you. No, of course not.
It's a complete coincidence that our band begins with a K. But this band, The Crackpots, I heard their song Proper Christmas, which is like a sort of love letter to the old Christmases of the late 70s, early 80s, in the style of kind of Chaz and Dave, Slade, and Madness. And it's a nice, catchy, positive message. It's got a smashing video, like some little puppets. And I thought, that's the kind of message I could get behind. And so here I am.
Here you are, helping to promote. They are puppets. So.
I'm getting behind it. Well, yeah, that's the thing. They're puppets, but they're run by a mystery puppet master that no one knows. A bit like Banksy or Kendo Nagasaki.
Although Banksy named himself the other day, didn't he? Did you hear about that?
No.
Yeah. Banksy. There was a video with Banksy, and he went, it's Robbie. So, because I remember on Scroobius Pips podcast with Goldie.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that? Yeah. A few years ago when Goldie said, oh, yeah, I was with Banksy.
Yeah.
And, you know, got Pips some nice coverage, I think, at the time. But, yeah, apparently there was a video the other day, some documentary that they're doing about Banksy. And so, you know, will the Crackpots be unveiled at some stage?
I don't know. I can't speak for them. I would imagine, you know, knowing people.
Yeah.
If it's successful, then probably someone will come out and take all the credit for it.
Yeah, do you reckon?
I'd imagine so.
But all the money's going to the Crackpots.
Well, yeah, I guess so. But what people don't realise is people think if you have a hit single, you're kind of like laying around on a lilo in a swimming pool, getting wanked off by supermodels. But
hang on, that isn't the case.
But no, in the 80s it was. Downloads of 59p each. We always did them as cheaply as you can possibly do them, because it obviously is better to sell lots.
For the first one then, so in 2020. So
yeah.
That's actually fascinating. So you got to number 5. So what does that mean financially?
So the first Boris Johnson song sold 45,000. Was it 79p? So, you know, it's thousands of pounds. But by the time you put in, you know, you actually work out the amount of time you spend on something, it takes... pretty much 3 months to record and promote a single, and not necessarily working full time. And then obviously, like, everyone has played on it and helped with the videos and stuff like that gets paid. And so as the years have gone on, each single has sold a bit more, but you make less money off it because I've sort of remixes do the singles, and each of them kind of gets paid for their
contribution. That's what you do, isn't it? Because you create a load of versions of that song.
Yeah.
So that, I guess it, you know, I mean, I remember again with that first one, just a big Twitter campaign, and a load of my mates were like, hey, you know, listen to this, buy this. And then it, and then you just end up listening to 3, 4, 5 different versions of it to help, you know, to help get it there.
Yeah, so it's each year, the amount of versions we've done has grown because there's a sort of, it's a bit of a loophole in the chart rules that you can have unlimited versions of a song.
And they count towards the same one.
They all count towards the same one. So, you know, you can have 20 versions of a song. And if someone, you know, if a big fan goes and buys all 20, that counts as 20 sales. But like I say, you're up against all the, you know, the Christmas songs that are getting streamed on Christmas playlists, you know, which generate massive sales. And every 100 streams counts as one sale. But, you know, the Christmas songs get streamed in their millions.
Is that right? Every 100 streams is one sale?
Yeah, on like a premium account. Yeah.
So why the song, like, why 2020? What made you bring that song out then? Because obviously we had Rage Against the Machine years ago, and that whole campaign. Was it a protest song? Was it, you know?
It was a protest song. I think so. Just before, because we got locked down in March 2020, I'd just put a sort of punk band together called The Cunts with a K, rehearsed a set of songs, and we were just about to kind of sort out some gigs, and then we got locked down. We had this album, and a late kind of addition to it was Boris Johnson is a Fucking Cunt, which was recorded around the time of the sort of first lockdown. Later in the year, fast forward to kind of September, October, Ginger, who's the singer of the Wild Hearts, must have found our song online, or someone had sent it to him, and he tweeted a link to the Boris Johnson is a Fucking Cunt on Spotify and just put Christmas number one ? Above it.
Right.
And from that, just people started.
So it wasn't even a purposeful thing from your side?
No. I kind of think, you know, looking back at that and pretty much everything I've done, it's never really a purposeful thing. It's stuff kind of happens by accident. But if you keep yourself, you know, if you keep your mind open and keep yourself in the game, then these things come along, you know. And so, that's how it all kind of kicked off. And then John Malta, who did the Rage Against the Machine campaigns, he tweeted about it. And then Charlie Brooker tweeted a link to it.
Yeah.
And so
that'll help.
Yeah, I mean, it did. That was kind of towards the end of October. You started to go, well, actually,
You might have a chance.
Yeah, this could be a thing.
Yeah.
I'd done a couple of chart campaigns sort of back in the day, like 2010-11, and got songs to like number 66 and number 63.
What songs were they?
The first one was a song called Use My Arse, I Was a Cunt.
Right, okay.
All about the compromises you have to make to be in the music business. And then the second one was a song called Fuck Sticks. But I had quite a sort of small fan base then and was playing, you know, playing pub gigs to sort of 100 and something people, but doing sort of 40 or 50 gig tours. But then obviously, the fan base had grown by 2020. And so we made a real good go of it. And also the topic of the song and the timing, Boris had said that we weren't going to get locked down again before Christmas. Yeah. And then went back, you know, as we're finding out now, no one knew what the fucking hell was going
on.
But he expressly said there was going to be no more lockdowns and then locked everyone down. And so I think people just went, you know what, fuck it. This is a way I can do something show.
It does. It feels like you're doing something, doesn't it? It feels like, you know, if we can get this message out there. But I guess that speaks then to a problem in the wider media. You can't talk about it. They wouldn't name the song, as you say. They wouldn't name Cunt and Cunt in the Gang. Was it The Cunts?
That was The Cunts.
The Cunts, yeah. Sorry, Mum. I will keep doing it.
It's all right, Mum. It's with a K.
Did you have any record labels come to you at any point and say, do you know what this show's promised? Let's chuck ourselves behind this as well.
No. I just think the kind of whole ethos of it is so outside of what the industry expects and the rules they play by, that it's just, it's always going to be a massive mismatch. Despite the fact the songs we've done the last few Christmases have all been really popular and have been increasingly hidden by the media because, you know, they sort of know that
it's gonna
if they don't report on it, it'll be hard for people to find out about. And so we kind of bombard
social media.
Completely. Yeah,
it's all social media and it's all people bringing it. So with the Crackpots, how many versions do you think, or do you know how many versions they're going to be doing?
I think the Crackpots have done, as far as I know, they're only doing 3 versions on all the mainstream platforms. And then I'm told on their Bandcamp, what they've done is they've done a collection of people sending in their own Christmas stories that right. they've set to a John Lewis style backing track of their song. Okay. And so people can go and buy those multiple versions from the Crackpots Bandcamp, and you can buy them cheaper there. And I think they're going to do a Spotify playlist as right. well of those versions.
If anybody wants to go and buy it, when can they buy it and where from?
It comes out on the 8th of December, and all the details and the links will be at properchristmas.info.
Why didn't you want to do a Christmas song in the manner of the ones you've done in the last few years?
Well, I think, you know, you can only beat your head up against the wall so many times. And I don't want to be someone that looks like they're profiteering off misery. You know, ultimately, all the money we've made from the last three Christmases have gone in to the next single to promote it, make the video, you know. And so this, you know, this idea is just, we're getting hundreds of thousands of pounds,
yeah,
you know, from it. It's just, you know, you sort of, if you do the maths, last year sold 50,000 at 59p, which, you know,
as you say, once you paid everybody,
paid all the remixes, made the video, and spent 3 months of your life working on it.
Do you know, a lot of the remixing? Do you do a lot of the production yourself?
I do. I do all the sort of, you know, the production of the single version, and then just farm it out to mates and collaborators who are all sort of independent as well. Right, so right. It sort of spreads the love around a little bit.
Now, talking about the media, I guess throttling is possibly a good way of putting it. The potential reach of your output. You had another song. It was about the monarchy.
Yeah.
What can you remember?
So there's been a couple, but in 2022, around the time of the Platinum Jubilee, we recorded a song called Prince Andrew is a Sweaty Nonce. And it got a few mentions in, you know, sort of online newspapers, but it was largely massively ignored. And again, the same, when it ended up getting to number 20 in the charts, and it was the best-selling single of the Jubilee. It outsold what was the big hit that week was old Kate Bush running up that hill, because it had just been on Stranger Things, and it outsold that. There was no reports of it in the media once it was in the charts, because I think it's just so outside of what official culture allows to be part of the mainstream narrative, and I think we have a way of talking about things in a very frank manner that the newspapers don't. You know, when you sort of look at the way the newspapers and the news and the media talk about
it's
things.
It's funny because, you know, they reported on, you know, Sweatgate or whatever the hell they called it. You know, like, people were reporting on it. It's not like they weren't talking about Andrew and, where did he go? Was it Pizza Hut?
Pizza Express in Woking. Because we did a publicity stunt in the week of release. 20 or so of us all wore Prince Andrew masks and converged outside Pizza Express in Woking. And we all held up banners saying Prince Andrew's a sweaty nonce and sung the song. And that same day, we done the meet there. We called ourselves all singing the song. And then we went to Buckingham Palace and sung the song outside there. And got home, put them on TikTok.
Yeah.
And the Woking one just went whoosh. And I thought, fucking hell, this is going to go viral. And it plateaued off at about 110,000, but that was like all sort of in a day. It really looked like it was going to go. But then the Buckingham Palace one just went zoom. Yeah, within 24 hours, it had done 1.4 million, which is like, you know, completely unheard of for my videos. My most popular videos before then, the Jimmy Savile one, amassed something like 650,000 views in 10 years, you know.
I've just got the song in my head. Yeah. It didn't start out as Jimmy Savile, it was Rolf Harris, wasn't it?
No, it was Jimmy Savile. We did a Rolf Harris version when he died recently. Jumped on the hearse bandwagon.
So, like, why this? So, what do you define yourself as? Like, what do you call yourself? Are you a comedic musician? Are you a musical comedian?
Well, I always said I was a minor internet hit singer, which, because, you know, there's a ceiling of how many people are going to like it or find it funny, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of dark humour. But I don't know. You can't just wear one. I think being a creative, you can't just wear one hat and make a living from it. You have to, you know, you have to have your fingers in lots of pies. So for these single campaigns, I'm a songwriter, I'm a producer, I'm an engineer, you know, record company, PR person, sleeve designer, publicist, radio plugger, singer, front person. So you have to wear all those hats to kind of make something work.
So why go down this road with it? Because you're clearly very, I mean, I can say it for you, like, very bright. You know, it comes across in even the songs. You know, a lot of people will think, oh, it's just puerile. But
I mean, it is
puerile. It is puerile.
It
is, but, you know, it comes across. I mean, I love the music. I know it's been spoken about before, but, you know, the simplicity and the kind of the it sounds happy. It sounds like happy music when it comes on, and then all of a sudden it's Sexy Kids made Jimmy Savile do what he did. Did you ever think of going down a different path with music?
I mean, you know, when sort of I was in my teens and early 20s, you know, would write regular songs, you know, but I've always written them alongside these songs. And, you know, looking back, it was really obvious, really early, that these were the ones that people were attracted to. And, you kind of reacted against that for a little while, but these were always the ones that people gravitated towards. Like I was in a band with Stu, whose studio we were in, called Serious Problem, like when we were, I suppose we were in our late teens, and there was, you know, sort of 10, 12, 14 of us just making a racket and, you know, singing really offensive songs. We had one called Take That, Our Cunts. and then from that, I went into a keyboard duo called Pubic Cube, and we'd just play like talent competitions and like little local pub gigs, and people would either love it and get it or really hate it. But you'd walk out at the end of the night and there'd be blokes pissed staggering off into the night singing the songs,
right?
And I think that's because if you use those, when you do comedy music, you can kind of get away with using tunes that, you know, regular songwriters wouldn't be able to touch because they're too cheesy. You know, like the Shake and Vac advert.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just you can use these major chord melodies that just stick in people's minds, you know, without having to worry about the credibility of the music.
Yeah. So when you were a kid, was music always the thing that you wanted to do?
No, I'd never really knew what I wanted to do. And even when I came out of school, which went for a succession of sort of low-paid jobs, worked in shops and
just like retail stuff.
Menswear mainly.
Yeah.
But you know, got sort of you'd always be under these kind of little despot managers, you know, you knew weren't as clever as you were.
Yeah.
But these, you know, just like little jumped up fuckwits, and, you know, sort of running their store like the Luftwaffe or something, and so we'd just wind them up. You know, me and I took hanging out with the Saturday Boys because they had no career prospects or dedication to their job, and you'd just do things to wind up the managers. You know, the shop meant everything to these people, and so I mean, it must have been awful having us working there. It must have been
right,
really
Kate.
But at the time, you're like, oh, these fucking people. So I did that for quite a few years after leaving school, and then a guy who worked for the youth service, who we used to DJ at the youth club that Sue and I used to go to. Yeah, a guy that worked for the youth service took me on there part-time, just working as like someone that made the posters and graphic design and, you know, and forms and stuff. And so that got me out as kind of full-time working 2 days a week, and I'd spend the rest of the week either making music or going to gigs, and then that was the tipping point where my life was more about music than it was
90s.
Yeah, that would have been like early 90s, and I was still doing some. I would DJ like weddings and stuff at the weekend. It's awful Essex weddings, you know, playing Wham and Gary Glitter when he could still fill a dance floor.
Yeah, Jesus. At that point, was music paying?
I mean, DJing was always just something where you'd earn a bit of extra cash to kind of make your money up, you know, that meant you could buy gig tickets and records and stuff.
Who were
you
going to see? Who were your favourite bands at the time?
We'd go and see all the sort of indie bands of the late 80s and early 90s. So, you know, go and see like the Inspiral Carpets, who I'd absolutely loved. I probably saw them like a dozen times. There was another indie, sort of poppy indie, because I've always liked the poppy end of indie. You know, I'm just a massive pop fan, and always have been. And there was a band called Airhead, who were from Kent, who would they were touring around at the time, and they had a single that sort of nearly made the charts. And we'd just go and see them in like Manchester and Leeds, and sort of sleep in a pub car park. We went to see like you know, Suede and Blur and, you know, and all those kind of bands, yeah, yeah. And Pulp. And
I guess they're the ones that I probably then became kind of aware of indie-wise.
Yeah.
I guess, when would they have been, like, 93, 94?
Yeah,
so I was 6 or 7. But, yeah. You know,
oh, right.
You know, yeah. But, like, getting to, you know, that's the first time you start picking music up. I think at that point, when was... It was sort of
always a thing, you know, since we did Serious Problem...
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It was really always a thing, you know, and probably before then as well, you know, but the first time I kind of used it as a vehicle for songs would have been in Serious Problems. So that would have been in like 1992.
Right.
And then Cunt and the Gang started as Cunt and the Gang in 2003.
Right. And what was the first Cunt and the Gang song?
The first ever one that would be, you know, that would be definitely Cunt and the Gang was Use My Arsehole as a Cunt. But then that was written probably sort of in the mid to late 90s when I was working for the council. I remember being sent off to do a tiling job at a youth service. I'd put some tiles around a sink. And I don't fucking know. But I remember just getting the idea for the song and just stopping what I was doing and went and got a sheet of green paper out of the youth centre office and just wrote it from start to finish. And I think I'd stopped doing Pubic Cube at that point and was, you know, I'd had a...
Pubic Cube's like comedy songs too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, Pubic Cube was just like...
It can't be serious. now we've got a ballad. It's a love song. Right.
Yeah, I'd probably stopped doing Pubic Cube at that point and was just in between doing anything. But then the idea just kind of came to us and it probably took, you know, three or four years of not wanting to have to go back to doing it. But, it calls you.
Is that what it was? Is it that you got bored with the 9 to 5?
I mean... I got bored with the 9 to 5 really, really quickly.
Yeah.
And so I was working for the youth service for like 14 years up until 2008. So there's no kind of like, everything kind of overlapped. I was working for the youth service 2 days a week. I was DJing and then I started club DJing up in London on Friday and Saturday nights, playing like 80s stuff in a gay club. So I was doing those two things, and I was doing both of those things when Cunt and the Gang started up.
Did the youth service know what you're doing as Cunt?
When I started, I'd already been there like 7 or 8 years, and when I done the first gig, I let a couple of youth workers who I was friendly with know that I was doing this gig up in... Oh, it was the first London gig, so this would have been about 2005.
Right.
And they told everyone. And... you know, obviously there were some people that I would have much preferred didn't go there.
Yeah.
But quite a big group came up to support us. And I knew I had this song called Maybe I'm a Nonce.
I've heard that one.
So that was the song that became Prince Andrew right. Is a Sweaty Nonce.
Okay,
I sort of reappropriated it because, you know, everything gets used again. So I had this song,
There's
Maybe
no
I'm
no such
a...
thing as a unique idea and all that?
No, exactly. So I'd had this song called Maybe I'm a Nonce, and I played it at the first couple of Essex gigs.
And, you work with kids.
but I wasn't definitively saying that I was a nonce.
Maybe you are. Maybe, but, yeah.
I mean, I'm not, but...
Cheers for clarifying. Yeah.
But, you know, so I'd played this song at the first couple of Essex gigs, and it made people really angry. I remember my mate Gels saying that he'd heard two blokes at the bar going, Maybe I'm a nonce. That means he is a nonce.
Oh, Lord. Is that something you enjoy, that kind of subversive, let's not get too academic about it, of course, but pressing people's buttons? Was that always something in you?
Do you know what? I would have said no, because I know it might sound strange, but I much prefer it when people are happy than when they're angry. But if someone's going to let something like that make them angry, then I'll just make it worse. Yeah. I'm perfectly prepared to just keep going until they lose their rag.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I've seen some people get really, really fucking angry at the gigs. The worst song for it was, I had this song called Wanking Over a Pornographic Polaroid of an Ex-Girlfriend Who Died. And the chorus was just basically me crying whilst pretending, you know, whilst masturbating this foam penis. And it just made people really angry.
Why?
I don't know.
It's funny. And this is, like, it's an important point to talk about, because comedies, like, do you think that there are things you shouldn't joke about? Is there too far?
I mean, like, that when, you know, when people say there's a line, there is a line, but it's not a line that's in one place all the time, because, you know, you can't joke about something terrible the moment it's happened. There's a point in time where it becomes acceptable to joke about it. Like the American comedian, was it Gilbert Gottfried who made the joke about the Twin Towers sort of the week after at Roast? And it was a massive relief for people, because no one felt like...
So do you think that's what comedy can do? It can take a serious situation and not make light of it, but almost make it bring people together over that shared thing?
I think so, but then I might just be saying it as an excuse for my horrible back catalogue. But no, I do think that there is, you know, it's a coping mechanism, you know, humour. And working for the youth service in the 90s, we went and visited the concentration camp and done all these kind of, you know, done a seminar. You realise that even in concentration camps, people were going through the bleakest, horriblest fucking experience, you know, in subhuman conditions. But some people still chose humour as their coping mechanism to get through it. And I think that, you know, in dark times, it is a way of just getting through it.
Gallows humour, isn't it? That's,
yeah.
You know, it's called that for a reason. And I would sooner go down that road and, you know, find something to smile or laugh about than, you know, just bury your head in absolute upset, which, if you look around, it's there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, so I guess, you know, a lot of your topics do center around, it's as you say, it's not like you're the sweaty nonce. It's not like you...
Oh, maybe.
Oh, Christ. On that gig where your youth center colleagues came to listen, to watch you do that, like, how did they feel about it? What was said afterwards?
Their reaction, people were largely sort of open-mouthed, but because, you know, because the weight of the people in the room laughed at it, and so people look around and go, oh, right, oh, it's okay.
It's such a social thing, isn't it?
It's okay. And I think a lot of the time, you know, when you see the you know, the sort of tabloid furore about something that a comedian said in their set, it is because they've taken it out of context and put it into print, and they've missed all the nuance and the kind of build up to it, you know. And in that room, when you're in a room full of people who are there for the purpose of kicking back, you know, having a good night and just laughing about things, you can get away. You can get away with a lot more. And it's sort of fun, you know, as a performer, to try and take people on that journey where they're going to end up laughing at something that ordinarily in everyday life they'd probably be horrified by.
I've got a thing, and I'm probably not the original, I'm definitely not the originator of this thought, but it's, if you're the kind of person that is humourless enough to think, right, that person that's saying that thing over there, and it's not crossed any legal lines yet, but, you know, shouldn't be saying that, I want to shut them down, I want to take that platform away from them, that's going to come to visit you at some point.
Yeah.
You know, if you're the kind of person that says, right, well, you know, I dislike that thing, therefore it shouldn't be, something you do or say will also at some stage be, you know, we'll cross that line inevitably, because the line, as you say, isn't in one place, both in terms of comedy, but also, you know, what's okay to say. I mean, you do a podcast called Acceptable in the 80s,
yeah,
right? Which is about what? I mean, actually, like, plug it. Tell us about that podcast.
Yeah, so that's a podcast that me and Stu do. And the idea was, when we started off, it was going to be a kind of nice nostalgia, a nice nostalgia podcast where we'd sit and, you know,
talk about your bands and talk about TV and
because we've always met up for a beer, you know, every few weeks or every month, and we just decided to do it whilst doing a podcast talking about The things, you know, we loved and remembered from the 80s. So we sort of, you know, talk about music and films and TV and you know, and just reflect back and remember some of the kind of stuff we got up to. And then it very quickly descended into just talking about snooker players' pubes and and speculating on the length of Billy Joel's cock. But that's,
where did you land on that?
Well, you'd have trouble landing on it. It's
oh,
tiny.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How do you know this?
You can just tell by looking at him. I have this gift where I can
it's
look.
Like,
I can
it's
look
like
at
gaydar,
some,
but
no, it's not a gaydar. It's like a cockdar.
But
I have this gift where I can meet someone, yeah, be it man or woman, and I will have a rough idea of what their genitals. Let's see now. I'm trying not to look at you whilst I have a rough idea of the size and dimensions.
That's hilarious.
Shape and collection of pubic hair around their genitals.
Well, I mean, anybody that meets you from now on, I want them to think of that. I want them to look you in the eye and know that that's what you're doing.
Similarly, all your listeners, I'd like them to look at that photo of you on on Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, I mean,
he's a big bloke.
Yeah. What's he making up for? But I looked yesterday. You are also the author of a wonderful collection of books called Bumface Poohans.
Co-author.
I think it might be the fourth one in it. Bumface Poohans and the Coronavirus Pandemic Lockdown was 155 in the Children's Books About the Government chart.
Oh, really?
So congratulations, cunt.
Wow, you've really made it.
Charting left and right, mate.
Out of all the children's books about the government,
we're at 155. It's nice.
Dizzy Heights.
I don't know where you go from here. You may as well give it up, mate.
Well, yeah, I mean, the massive haul of money that that's going to bring in.
When did you write Bumface Poohans? Is it something you always wanted to do? Where did the idea come from?
I don't know. You know, just every lazy celebrity writes a children's book,
don't they?
Or gets someone to write a children's book for them. I don't know. One of my sort of long-time collaborators, Mr. Gels, who's been a mate of mine and Stu since we were teenagers, I was around his house one day because he plays guitar in The Cunts. And went round his house to do some cunts-related business. And on his fridge, he just had a picture of this character who had a bum for face and these kind of like Mr. Whippy poo hands. And I went, what the hell is that? And he went, that's Bumface Poo Hands. And so I said, well, what is it? He said, oh, I do little drawings and put them in my daughter's lunchbox to make her laugh. And it just, you know, it's just really... really eye-catching. And I said to him, have you ever thought of doing a children's book with it? And he said, well, no, not really. Like, I wouldn't know where to start. Yeah. And so that's what we did. We just got our heads together and wrote a couple of the stories. The first one was called A Birthday Surprise, where all these little friends come around for a birthday party. I won't say what happens in the end, because it's a plot spoiler.
We don't want to spoil it.
A plop spoiler.
Again, it's just so, so silly. And that's what I love about it. It's just, it's so daft, so kind of, not subversive, because it's right in your face, isn't it? But, you know, just the stains that he leaves everywhere. And like, it's like the joke that it's a one-note joke.
I know that.
But I'll listen to it all day long.
Like,
you know.
There's two jokes. He's got a bum for a face and he's got poo for hands. But there are just two jokes. But then that was Little Britain, you know.
Yeah, it's, of course.
You know, in the Fast Show, there's one joke for each of them characters.
Yeah.
But if you kind of do the same joke again, people sort of know what's coming. But if you're clever enough, you know, you can still sort of surprise them a little bit. You know, you know when. So we had one of the books was called A Day in the Park. And the minute you see a big white fluffy dog bounding towards him, you know exactly what's going to happen.
But you took something you didn't know how to do. You didn't know how to write a book, presumably, or, you know, or publish a book before that.
No.
Or self-publish a book. But you took something, you took an idea and ran with it. Just a mate's drawing on his fridge went from that to creation. I think a lot of people, and certainly people that listen to this, will be the kind of people that'll have a million ideas. It's what you do with them. It's in the execution, isn't it? And I think...
Yeah.
Is that something you kind of pride yourself on? Is that something you...
I think I'm quite practical. I like to... create something and finish it. Because if I don't finish it, I'll get this nagging feeling, it hangs over me until that's finished. And once I'm finished it, often that's where I fall down in the kind of promotion of it, because the joy I get is from the creating and completion
of
something.
Artists, don't they? They say that about a lot of creatives. It's the promotion that people struggle with. So when you find somebody that's both good artistically and promotionally, maybe they don't need people like me, the PR type people, that's when you're onto a winner. I mean, I'd argue that you're pretty good at promoting.
I force myself to do it, but I mean, it's like two different parts of your brain, the kind of creative side and the promotion side. And if I'm perfectly honest, once it gets to the promotion side, my creative brain has moved on to the next thing. And I always can't wait to get my teeth into the next project and get the promotion bit out of the way. But, you know, as I've discovered over the years, if you don't promote something, you just end up with 500 books keeping all the doors open around your mums. Yeah. So you have to promote it. But the trouble is sort of when you're, when you're doing everything yourself, hawking stuff around sometimes feels a bit like you're asking for a favour from people. Yeah. And I don't like that side of it. That's why it's nice to hand it over to a PR company, because, you know, because you can go, this is brilliant. If I'm there on Facebook saying, this is brilliant, I always feel like people are going, well, you're going to fucking say that because you did it.
A, that, and B, I think as supportive as people can be, and I felt it with this, I felt it with a book I wrote, various things, people get pissed off. People are like, oh man, he's talking about that thing again. And I've always had this mindset of, well, if I don't promote myself, nobody's going to. If I don't, you know, stick up for myself and have some form of self-belief in that thing. But
I agree with that.
Do you know what I mean? Like, even with the podcast, I had a good friend say, oh, fucking hell, yeah, I know you've got a podcast. And it's like, I personally think it's about time straight white males in their 30s had podcasts, I think, you know.
Where are they?
Yeah, where's the representation?
We're definitely a much maligned group, aren't we? Yeah, we are.
You know, it is funny how people, especially people kind of, you know, 1-2 degrees separated from you, can get a bit like, oh, shut up, mate.
Well, just mute me then.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. That's very true.
And also, but social media is a weird construct, because the people that kind of, you know, the people that know you in real life outside of social media, you have a different relationship to them, to the people, you know, that kind of follow you on social media. And so, you know, people that you see every day down the pub are going to get fed up with what you're putting on your social media, because they know that. And it's the same as, you know, I found myself on Facebook, like, hating people's kids because they post pictures of them all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, I shouldn't be wanting to punch a 7-year-old in the face, but that's my problem, because I'm looking on there, you know.
Yeah. Where do we go from punching 7-year-olds?
Kicking them.
Were your family, so when you were doing these songs as a teenager and you know pubic cube, like, were your family quite supportive of it? Like, what do they think?
I think my mum's largely disappointed and has been variously and consistently over the last 30 odd years since I left school.
Right.
But, you know, I think she's kind of finally realised that I'm not going to go and work for the civil service or get a proper job. I had an interview for the civil service, but I mean, they can spot it a mile off if you're just going because you don't know what to do.
Right.
You know, I mean, that wasn't recently. That was
a couple of years ago.
In about 1989. But, so my mum was largely disappointed across those years. And then my dad was a self-employed builder, and him and his friends would talk about some horrific things, which I think, you know, kind of led to my higher tolerance level for all kinds of subjects. And he was quite pleased and quite sort of...
He quite liked it, didn't he?
Yeah. My sister, who recently passed away, would help us with all manner of things. She was a couple of years younger than me, and she'd come and do the merch at gigs and do the door and drive us about and come, you know, on the sort of jaunts up to Edinburgh, she'd come and stay for the month and do the, do the door for us. And also, we started doing videos in sort of when YouTube first came about in 2005. And so she'd always be in the videos or behind the camera and just, you know, generally kind of up for helping out and having a bit of a laugh, wearing various unflattering outfits, which she would roll her eyes and then just get on with it.
So that was Lily. And so Lily was quite supportive of the cunts in general.
She was a cunt in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But she, I mean, yeah, she, she made lots of friends at the gigs, where she's a lot more sociable than I am. I'm just not a very sociable person, but for the gigs, you know, I make an effort, because I like meeting people and I like chatting to people, but I struggle with the idea, you know, of being in big groups of people. But my sister was a completely different animal. You know, she was very, very sociable.
Well, mate, I saw you and Stu, you know, mentioning it, and then I read the replies, and it was just an outpouring of love.
Yeah.
For her, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Such an incredible... Are you reading all of that? Are you seeing it all?
I've sort of dipped in and out, but it's still quite raw.
Mate, this is last week we're talking, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm...
Yeah, I didn't want to do this podcast. Yeah, I can't believe you made me.
No, I appreciate it, man, but it's a massive outpouring of love.
I mean, she was just very sociable and very likeable, and she'd come away from a gig with like five people's phone numbers, and I'd be like, oh, fucking hell, not them.
So I saw somebody say that she was a large reason for Use My Asshole happening as a cunt, obviously.
Yeah, we were living together in, I guess this would probably be like mid-90s, and we had a couple of mates that would come round, and we'd just spend every night in playing Nintendo 64, just spend every night in kind of smoking and just saying outrageous things to try and outdo everyone else. And that was where the wanking over a pornographic Polaroid song came from. I had this wanking and crying mime that I would do to appall my sister. She hated it. And so, you know, because I knew she hated it, I would just continue to...
Okay, you can't see that, but it's wonderful. It's everything you think it is.
And so in return, she one night just came out with the phrase, throw me up against the wall and use my arsehole as a cunt.
Which Jesus obviously, Christ, no, Lily.
Yeah, coming from your sister, it was a jaw-dropping moment. And then, you know, as that phrase kind of filtered in, you know, I equated it with being made to do things that you didn't really want to do to be able to kind of get to the next rung of the ladder. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's where the song came from.
Well, there you go. I mean, it's a hell of a legacy.
Yeah, I'm sure my mum would be very proud listening to this.
Does your mum listen to your stuff?
No.
No?
No.
What song do you have that you would not want your mum to listen to?
Paperboy.
What's Paperboy?
It's a song about being attracted to your newspaper delivery person.
Right. Because they remind you of a crush from school, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I won't ruin the end. But and I won't ruin the song, but go and have a look. I think one of the first songs that that brought me to you was "A Lonely Wank in a Travel Lodge,"
which is
you know, relatable, right?
Well, there was another one that I'd used the phrase for a while,
right?
And it was up in Edinburgh. I was speaking to another comedian and mentioned that phrase, and she said, "You should write a song with that title." And I guess, you know, suddenly you're like, of course I should.
It's that thing with comedians, musicians, you know, when you're constantly on the road or travelling around, I guess, you know, what have you got? Are you going to talk about planes, or are you going to talk about hotels and, you know, all that stuff? So I guess I can see how it came about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just remember. It's so catchy as well. Again, every time we've mentioned a song in this, I've then got it played in my head. I'm like, shut up, Rich.
Oh, excellent. I take great pride in that.
No, I bet you. It's wonderful, but I like it being there, so it's okay. There's another... I don't just want to constantly dance around, I guess, the things you've done, but you've done so many things that there's so much to talk about. You had a recent Kickstarter campaign, or recent-ish Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
For Shannon Matthews, the musical, the movie.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it went bonkers, didn't it?
Yeah, it went really, really well. So I'd written this musical about the kidnapping of Shannon Matthews, the Yorkshire girl, Shannon Matthews. I wrote it in 2010, which was like shortly, because I think it happened in 2008.
Right.
And it was one of those things, I'd never written a musical before, but I started to get ideas about songs that Karen Matthews would sing. So there was a band I played with in Edinburgh called Arse to Mouth, and they had a song called Billy Ain't Dead, He's in My Shed. And the minute the Shannon Matthews thing happened, I just started thinking, Shannon ain't dead, she's under my bed. And it was one of those things that once you start thinking about it, you know deep in your heart of hearts that you're going to end up having to do it, because it just eats away at you. And I was just like, the amount of time and effort that you'd have to put into writing a musical about the Shannon Matthews kid, or indeed any musical, you know, it's a lot of work, because it's a kind of long form project.
How long is it? An hour and a half, is it?
It's the CD coming at an hour and 15, and then the film is an hour and a half. So
it's a lot of work. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Did you do it by yourself?
Yeah, apart from that original song that I kind of reappropriated from that band song, everything else I kind of done.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of newspaper information on Karen Matthews and Craig Meehan and the family set up around Shannon Matthews. And the more you read about it, because, you know, there were lots of lurid tabloid headlines, the more you actually read into it, the more I kind of started to think, well, she's like a classic sitcom character, you know, like Basil Fawlty.
There's something weirdly, it's very British, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? The whole thing is, you know, it felt, and I watched that programme as well with Sheridan Smith, you know, watched that. What took you from... Oh, I can imagine Karen Matthews singing "Can't Work, Won't Work" to to where you got to.
It was just that I kind of got, I got three or four song ideas, which was "Can't Work, Won't Work." There was one called "Different Dads," because it was, you know, in all the write ups that she had seven children by five different fathers.
Yeah,
you know.
Which is fine.
But it kind of just said a lot about the dysfunctional, chaotic life that she'd led. And I didn't want this at any point to be sort of punching down on people.
Because that's what I guess some people said, isn't it? In, you know, some of the newspaper articles and, you know, the MPs that, of course, want to just get bloody some space in the news. There was an aspect of, oh, this isn't okay. And then what's your response to that?
It is largely just telling the same story that the BBC told on the Moorside, but just with some songs for a bit of levity. And, you know, and I definitely don't think it's any worse than the constant tabloid reporting of where she is now with her pedo husband, you know. And they just, every few months, they just tell, they'll say Karen Matthews has been found living in the south of England, married to a pedo. And then they just repeat all the other stuff, you know, from the case.
I'm not one of these people, and I'm not a comedian for a start, but, you know, the whole... You know, oh, everybody's getting cancelled. You can't, you know, you can't joke about anything. But it does feel like your musical, for instance, was maligned in a way that it didn't feel fair. Didn't feel, you know, nobody's watched it yet.
Yeah,
at the time, right? Nobody had even seen it yet.
I found that with so last year they went to the Edinburgh Fringe. A company took it to the Edinburgh Fringe and put it on there, and two of the reviews hadn't even seen it. You know, they talked about it.
Made up their mind already.
Yeah.
They clearly
made up their mind without actually seeing it, you know. I do think with comedy, the first consideration should be, is it fun? Is it funny? And then you worry about everything else. And I think as long as it isn't horrible and hateful, and I think as long as it's kind of accountable for what it's saying, which I think I am and I think it is, then I don't really see what the problem is, because if you don't like it, just fucking turn it off.
It's something else. There's a lot going on. There's a lot to listen to. There's a lot of content out there. What you're joking about, what you're saying is, this is a ridiculous situation. I mean, wasn't he allergic to something silly? Or, like, wasn't, you know, there are these silly kind of aspects around, you know, around the whole show.
There's loads and loads of ridiculous things that happened. So that her partner, Craig Meehan, took an overdose.
That was what it was, yeah.
But he just basically drank a bottle of Calpol. The more you read into it, the more you realise there's loads of things like that, you know. And so Karen sees Shannon on the TV, you know, in a news report, and she goes, "Look, Craig, Shannon's famous." And he goes, "She's not famous. She's missing," you know. And it's lots of things like that actually happened in real life, and you're like, this is so bizarre and unusual. Like, it's got to be parodied, you know. And that's the reason behind it, because for me, you're able to turn Karen Matthews into, you know, like Rigsby, like Basil Fawlty, like David Brent, one of these awful, self-centred, delusional, quintessentially English characters who is unintentionally hilarious because they're so self-centred and horrible, you know. And there is comedy in that, and whether people think that's all right or not, it's up to them whether they watch it or not.
Everybody's got a different line, right?
Yeah,
and that's the thing. I mean, it got 600 plus people backed the movie version on Kickstarter, so that's $26,000.
Yeah, to make the whole thing.
How's that coming along?
Yeah, it's all filmed, mostly edited, and then so there's a guy called Mike Fordham who has helped me with my videos since I first started, sort of back in the early 2000s. He made the video for Use My Arsehole. When we first, he just came along to a gig one night and said, you know, can I come and film your next gig? And we got talking because he had a little Sony tape handycam at the time. And so he came along and him and Lily filmed the video for Use My Arsehole as a Cunt, and Mike edited it all together. And then from there, he's done like nearly all of the other videos with us and has just kind of learned on the job and grown his gear and been, you know, doing other things on
the
side.
Is that what he does then, mainly? That's so,
yeah, he's a video maker. And
so I guess the beauty of it is you were prevented from showing it in a few places in Edinburgh, weren't you? There were a couple of places that wouldn't let you play it there. They
got a venue and it was all signed and sealed. You know, they're all signed the contracts, and then the venue came back and said, actually, no, we this is not the kind of thing we want on. But they'd already, they knew of my history.
Yeah.
But I think it must have, you know, the backers or the advertisers must have just seen it and just gone, no, we don't want to be associated with it.
So the beauty of it being a movie means that it's easily watchable, right? You know, it can get out there in a much more simplified way.
Yeah.
I guess was that the reason for doing it, for creating the movie? Not just because Shannon Matthews the musical, the movie sounds funny.
Yeah. you just keep adding, and then it'll be Shannon Matthews the musical, the movie, the musical, because we'll have to do a musical of the movie.
Nice.
But I guess the reason behind doing a film was, at first I just recorded the CD because there was no other opportunity to kind of get it put on anywhere. And then the opportunity arose to have it on at the Edinburgh Fringe. And then there was such a good company of actors and people involved in the production of that it seemed like the right time to just go, do you know what, these people...
Is it all the same people then?
Yeah, it's everyone that was in the Edinburgh show, because they know half the battle is, if you're making an independent film, getting people to learn their lines, you know, and having everyone who's available. And you had a company of people that were all loved it, had a great time up in Edinburgh, spending a month in each other's company and didn't kill each other.
How many people are in that company?
Seven or eight. It's quite a small cast. You've got Karen Craig, Michael Donovan, D.I. Radgett, the old school copper, and PC World are the kind of...
PC World.
Are the five, you know, sort of main players, and then there's a couple of girls that kind of played various roles and did backstage stuff as well.
Shannon? Is Shannon in it?
No, this was the thing from the start. Well, you know, Shannon's not in it. She's missing.
She's missing it. Yeah, missing. I wasn't sure she cropped up at the end in a song.
No, in the CD version, I played the part of Shannon, because I thought, you know, if I have to give other people the parts, I'm going to have the title role.
Yeah.
So you just kind of hear a whimper as she's taken out the bed base.
Right. You've got a song as well called Fred and Rose. Now, we were talking before I came. I'm from Gloucester, and most people, if they know anything of Gloucester, know two things, and it's cheese rolling and Fred and Rose.
Yeah.
Who was that? Who was singing on that? Was it you doing both voices?
So that was me. It was a duet, and I've got a hand puppet called Little Cunt.
Right.
And now, so that was a duet between me and Little Cunt.
Now, I mean, it's a lovely song. It's a very touching song.
Yeah. It's kind of you to say so, but everyone's turned off by now anyway.
Yeah. After the Crackpots hopefully gets to number one.
I hope so. Those guys really feel like they're going places.
They are going places. They've tried really hard, as it seems. And you're doing a great thing by getting out there and promoting on their behalf. What happens, like, what are you going to be doing after that? Have you got another album? Like, what are you working on right now?
So it's quite all-encompassing doing a Christmas campaign, as the Crackpots have found out.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why I've kind of thrown my hat in their ring to help them out.
Very nice.
But once Christmas is out of the way... I've got to do all the music for the Shannon Matthews the musical, the movie, that comes out at the end of April.
The movie comes out at the end of April.
Yeah, we've got the premieres at the end of April.
Nice. Where are you doing it?
At the Prince Charles Cinema in London.
Oh, brilliant, yeah.
I've got the second Cunts album to finish off because we've got loads of kind of bits and sort of disparate singles, but I've realised they're all the same tempo.
Right.
Because I've been writing different versions of the same song for the last 2 years, and I've got nearly 10 songs that are all the same tempo and the same kind of glam rock beat.
Right.
And so I'm thinking about making the album a kind of mega mix style, you know, that kind of from one song goes into the other.
Nice.
And they're all songs about, you know, being dissatisfied with the way things are run in this country.
Okay, so it's quite political again. I mean,
it's just kind of collecting the royal family songs and the government songs, mm-hmm. and because ultimately I think they're all part of the same problem, you know, that money gets funneled up from the people that need it to the people that don't, and that's going to be the overarching theme of the album, but I'm going to try and keep it fun.
And I think you can. I mean, you already have done with your political things. Like, are you quite political outside of music?
I don't think I ever was. Really, and then just kind of from... So when I did the Use My Arse, I Was a Cunt campaign back in 2010, just after Nick Clegg had formed the coalition government, yes, with the Conservatives, and one of the versions of Use My Arse, I Was a Cunt we called the Nick Clegg story, you know, because obviously he was someone that had given up all his, you know, beliefs and, you know, compromised
yeah,
his beliefs in order to kind of be part of the power game. And I think that just kind of awoke something in me, and I started looking around more and spotting injustices, which, you know, I think I've been fairly oblivious to up until then. And then when the pandemic kind of happened, you know, it sort of seemed like it was one rule for the people in charge and one rule for everyone else. And then when you realise, you know, it feels like quite a natural progression from looking at the way, you know, the people in power behaved in the pandemic to where, you know, if you go up London and visit Buckingham Palace, you'll see all these people in uniforms with gold and silver helmets holding guns and sat on horses unable to, you know, and they're not allowed to move. And they're all just there to protect this family that are living in great big fucking palaces, you know, got millions of pounds and are just, you know, they're all right. While
they're
people
right.
are using food banks and there's a cost of living crisis, so people can't afford to heat their homes and feed their kids, and there's this family living in palaces, all surrounded by, you know, guardsmen, and you start to go, hold on a minute, how have we ended up in this situation? And I think it was kind of on Jubilee Week when they were ferrying the Queen's crown around in a chauffeur-driven, custom-made Rolls Royce, you know, this crown with all gold and jewels, and you're like, fucking hell, you know, and like, and you go down Asda and there's people shoplifting because they can't afford to feed their kids. How have we got in a situation where that's okay? And once you start thinking like that, it's hard to leave it alone. And I know, like, my music over the last couple of years has become a bit more serious, and I want to go back to wanking, crying and celebrity pedos, but I just need to do this.
Get this out.
Do this next Cunts out. It's called, the album's called It's All a Load of Bollocks and They're All Just Cunts. and I think once I've done that, I'll be able to just go, right, that's everything I've got to say on the subject.
I mean, it's quite Sex Pistols, isn't it? When you think about that, like, you know, was it Never Mind the Bollocks?
Yeah.
Are they an inspiration?
Yeah, completely, yeah. I mean, the thing that's been quite an eye-opener for me is what the Sex Pistols done, you know, 45 years ago, is still seen as unusual and kind of, you know, anarchic. And all the institutions that they were complaining about
exactly the same.
Are still exactly the same, you know, and I include the BBC in that, about the BBC support the royal family and uphold the government and the system and order, you know, and they're all part of the same problem for me. And when Donald Trump talks about fake news, like, I know he's an odious individual and... you know, and he's largely responsible for lies and misinformation. But there is a fake news media because they give you a veneer of respectability and they have a way of talking about things that keeps you from talking about things truthfully and what's actually going on. And this, through the pandemic, I would go out walking every day and I'd walk past the news agents and you'd see the front pages of, you know, of the Mail, the Express and the Sun, and to a lesser extent the Mirror, but they don't tell you the news. What they're doing is they're telling you what they want you to think, and big swathes of the country get all their views from what they're told to think by, you know, these rags that are run by billionaire owners whose interests are all tied up with a Conservative government and making money and funneling money up to them. And their main interest is to keep the status quo as it is, because once people realise what a load of bollocks it is, there'd be an uprising.
Have you got any songs in there about the media?
Not at the moment, but I've kind of, you know, sort of touched on them.
I guess you've been on the other side of it, though. You've been on the side where something is genuinely capturing the imagination of the public in, you know, your Christmas hits, and yet they still won't talk about it because it doesn't suit the purpose. It doesn't fulfil a role Instead, it goes to Lad Baby, who isn't doing a song this year, is he?
No,
I don't think so.
But the thing is, I mean, I can understand why he did last year's one, because, you know, he had four Christmas number ones.
Yeah, and, you know, going,
and
five makes the
five beats the Beatles, and also it keeps the grift going.
Yeah.
You know, it was all the wheels were coming off last year. They sold half last year that they did the year before, so that's why they're not doing it this year.
I see. Was it all for charity? Is that what it was?
Well, they would tell you that, you know, and he said in several online videos, it's all for charity, but apparently it was all the profits go to charity,
right?
And they never told you what the costs were. With Band Aid, you know, which I think kind of set a precedent, everyone worked for nothing, and all the proceeds went to charity. But Lad Baby's an industry, you know, and for me, the fact that he wasn't a millionaire when he started making charity records and became a millionaire off the back of making charity records and flogging sausage roll themed merch, there's something fundamentally a bit Captain Tom's daughter-ish. Without saying there's definitely something dodgy going on, it all feels a little bit like if someone had a closer look, they might find something. They might not.
Yeah, it's worth having a look at.
Just have a look. Serious Crime Squad. If you're scratching around for something to do over Christmas, just have a little look.
That's why they're not doing it. So next album is next year.
Yeah.
Do you think it will come out in 2024?
That will come out in 2024. Yeah.
Yeah. So the movie and then that.
Yeah.
So I mean, keeping you busy.
Yeah. But I mean, there's always something to do. I'm not someone that scratches around for ideas.
Yeah.
I've got a million ideas and a big list of stuff that goes on for the next 2 or 3 years, a lot of which I'll just never get around to do, you know. But that's the frustration of not getting it done is what drives me to carry on doing it.
Do you feel, it's a personal question, but do you feel financially comfortable in relation to doing this? Because there'll be people that listen to this that think, I love the idea of going out and doing my own thing and really being my own, you know, creative boss and you know, executing ideas and making what they can, having fingers in lots of pies, as you've said. At what point does that become something that pays well enough for you to go, okay, right, Wolf, away from the door, you know, I'm doing all right?
I mean, I always worked, you know, I worked in Lakeside and was still making music at the time, and then worked my 2 days for the council and DJed, and then started doing Cunt and the Gang, and so the council become the worst thing that I was doing. But I still didn't have a financial tipping point where I was earning enough money to jack it in until sort of 2008, and then there was a tipping point where I was earning enough money from DJing and gigging with Cunt and the Gang to bin off the council. So I binned off the council, and then DJing became the worst thing I was doing. And I would, you know, I would clock watch so badly when I was DJing. Like, you know, I'd think, right, I'm going to play 10 records and not look at my watch, which is awful because people imagine
loads
DJs...
People love that, don't they?
People imagine DJs have a really good time, but no, not me.
Right.
Because it'd be... But I think I'd become spoilt by, like, you know, the gigs I was doing were so fantastic that DJing just felt like a real bind. But I look back now really fondly on it, and was really privileged to play these big clubs. But yeah, it was at the time it was the worst thing that I was doing. So I was trying to organise enough gigs so that I could bin off the DJing. And eventually there was a tipping point with that, and I had enough gigs that I could bin off the DJing. And the thing is, around that time, you'd be able to gig And at the gigs, you'd sell CDs and T-shirts, and that would be another source of income, you know. And the CDs sold reasonably well online, you know. I sort of had a little online shop, but now physical merch is, you know, but you still sell T-shirts at the gig, but CDs, DVDs, all those kind of avenues are closed off, and you have to use the music as like a loss leader for selling merch and gig tickets. So the whole industry of it has changed, but you know, I've had times where it hasn't been going so well, and I've gone back. I've got a mate who's a plumber and done tiling for him just to kind of.
How recently was that?
Just before the pandemic.
Right.
But during the pandemic, I was doing sort of online shows on YouTube, and because I'd just written my book the year previous, and so I was.
I cunt. Is that I Claudius? Yeah, is that a play on that? Yeah.
It's a sort of play on that, and iTunes.
Yeah.
I was doing this online show, reading bits from that every night, and then I set up a Patreon, and so people started supporting us. You know,
that digital content creator ability to earn from things like this, right? You know, it's.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful because it puts the power in your hands a little bit until Patreon say he says what?
Yeah, I mean, you know. Patreon has definitely got us through the last few years of just knowing that there's. I've got millions of patrons. I've got about 120, but it just keeps things ticking over. Knowing that every month, you know, that money's going to come in, and it means that, you know, you're going to be able to pay your bills. And right now, what am I going to do with my time?
Yeah,
you know,
that's what it becomes. Financial security to me is the second that you're like. Bills aren't a concern this month, and hopefully even next month, and maybe even the next, you know, and the more that you can extend that runway, it just gives you such creative freedom.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, the best place for a creative person like yourself to be, is not worrying about the bloody gas and electric.
Yeah.
Not worrying about that bill over there. So as I said, for some people, they'll probably see it and feel like it's out of reach for them, but you're saying it's not. It's something you can absolutely do. You just got to
be.
I love your, that was the worst thing I was doing. So that gets binned off until you don't have the worst thing anymore, until you just creatively.
There'll
free,
always
right?
be a worst thing.
What's the worst thing? What's the worst thing now?
This. Sitting here with you.
No.
I mean, no. Do you know what? I guess at the moment, the worst thing is the admin the admin side of things.
Mm.
But you know, it's just a necessary evil. If you're going to do anything, you have to dot the I's and cross the T's.
That makes sense. Yeah.
But you know, I think a lot of it is persistence. You know, you've got to be so persistent and keep believing in yourself. And you get knockbacks, but it's how you just sort of dust yourself down and carry on. And if you really believe in something, you've just got to carry on and carry on and carry on. The Pet Shop Boys didn't have any hit singles till they were in their 30s. Ian Dury didn't have singles till he was in his 30s, and Jarvis Cocker didn't have hit singles till he was in his 30s, and all those people could have just packed it in and been journalists or you know, whatever it was they wanted to do.
I feel like you could have a career as a motivational speaker, cunt. That's inspiring.
I just need to use the word nonce a bit less, and those doors will open up.
One final question I want to end on. Have you ever worried about yourself? Because obviously some of the things you do say do upset people. Have you ever been, you know, you're a big bloke, but, you know, have you ever worried that somebody
about your personal safety.
Yeah, you have.
Yeah, I mean, I've been assaulted on stage a few times.
Assaulted, like somebody's hit you, or
thrown a punch, and
I had
other times when like ladies had sort of attacked me on stage. It was it's the wanking and crying song. It just makes people really angry. Sorry about that song, but I do worry about. You know, your personal safety. And to be honest, like when you kind of go out and do gigs and meet people, it's always in the back of your mind. You know, you're always looking for where your next assailant is going to come from. Because once it's happened a couple of times, it's hard not to. And it's quite, you know, I think in a lot of ways that did kind of spoil gigging for me. That like the last couple of years, I went out on my own gigging in 2015 and 2016, you're kind of sort of worrying a little bit about your personal safety. But I guess it's horrible because it stops you interacting with people. Like, you know, because what I used to do was I would turn up at gigs, I would be there from the minute I got there for sound check. I'd be just available for selfies and chatting with people and signing things and having photographs. When you're worried about your personal safety, it puts the feeling of dread about doing that, which is a shame because it means lots of people lose out because of just one lone wolf.
I mean, somebody attacked you with a water gun, but it wasn't water in it, was it?
It was his piss. It was his acrid piss.
Fucking piss. Why? What did he say?
I did a tribute to the song Amy Winehouse, and about 6 months later, this guy must have been an Amy Winehouse fan, and he was still stewing about it, and he turned up to one of my gigs and pulled out this water pistol and just started spraying it and saying, "It's my piss, it's my piss, it's my acrid piss."
Acrid as well. Have you seen that guy, the succulent Chinese meal? Have you seen that video?
No.
Oh, mate, I'll show it you after. It's fucking hilarious. It's that sort of, why reach for that word?
Yeah.
You know, why reach for the word succulent? He's been arrested at the time. He's like, a meal? A succulent Chinese meal? Get your hand off my penis?
That guy. Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
It's like, why acrid? But anyway, so he sprayed you and he shouted that it was his piss.
Yeah. It held up a newspaper saying "Insult to my Amy," which was about a fashion show where they apparently dressed up as Amy Winehouse. So he was obviously like cheesed off about the Amy Winehouse tribute song. Well, I thought it was quite nice, but I think he thought it was in bad taste.
Right.
I just got the red mist and clumped him one.
Mate, I feel like that's entirely valid, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I feel that's...
What copper in the world's going to arrest a man that's just not...
So, yeah, what copper in the world's going to arrest a man soaked in...
Yeah.
soaked in acrid piss.
Yeah.
That was that. And he sort of ran out the venue and then posted about it on his Facebook.
Oh, he did.
You know.
So it was all for that then? It was all for... Because that's, I guess, a lot of these people, there is an aspect of attention to it. It's like, that was me, I did that.
Yeah.
Christ. Are you going to go back to gigging after the album?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll definitely go and do some gigs next year. So, you know, if you want to come and assault me at one... There'll be 20 or so opportunities up and down the country. I'm just going to get a great, big, burly fucking minder.
Yeah.
But so...
Or just take a water gun. Get a massive super soaker and just piss in it beforehand.
I'll go one better.
Yeah. Oh. So, Crackbots, people can download it from anywhere they listen to music. Where can they buy it from?
If you go to properchristmas.info, there'll be links to all the downloads. It'll be available on Amazon, iTunes, and all your normal platforms. Nice. And there'll be a Spotify playlist and stuff with links at
you'll find it there. We'll put links to it as well. Nah, not at all. Thank you very much, man. That was eye-opening. it was a journey. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, man. Nice.
Cheers, man.
Nice
one. And we're back in the room. I hope you enjoyed it. It was, I mean, I really enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed myself during that, as you can no doubt tell, because my mutley laugh constantly throughout. I think it was probably quite the pain to edit that. But Gunt's had this incredible fan base for years, and it only continues to grow as he achieves more and more success. And fingers crossed for the Crackpots, who are definitely, despite the K in Crackpots, definitely not Cunt. Thank you so, so much for listening. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for being supportive. Thank you for all the kind things. 2023, for me, will always go down as the year that I finally made the leap into doing this, and I cannot wait to see where it takes me and us. And I just hope your 2023 has been good. I hope it ends in a beautiful way. And, sorry, that sounds really morbid. I mean, I hope you have a lovely Christmas, basically. and that you have a great new year. I'll be back in February, March with the first episode again. That's Brian Cox, the actor. Very, very excited for you to listen to that one or watch it. And also the other incredible guests we've got lined up. I should probably get myself into better shape, shouldn't I? You know, if we're going to be filming. God, I'll have to lay off the mince pies and whiskey. Anyway, have a good one. Merry Christmas to all that do celebrate. You know, happy festive season. I don't know. I forget the right things to say at this point. But have a great one. I'm looking forward to being back in 2024. And let's see what we can do with this, eh? Thank you very much. Bye.
mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.